This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Most of us have worked several different jobs with varying degrees of enjoyment. Even if you've been in one career that you love for most of your working life, you've probably at least had a summer job, maybe as a teenager, that was more tedium than career advancement. Some lucky people find a job that they love and are able to stick with it for as long as they want to, but I'm guessing the majority of us have memories of jobs we've loved and jobs we've hated. Maybe that's too strong a word. Disliked. Today, we're giving you space to vent. You know you still harbor that frustration somewhere deep inside of you. But we also want to hear about how you found a job that you love and what's gone into your calculation in taking the good or the bad job. Margaret from Wyndham wrote to us to say her worst job was, quote, sweeping cigarette butts out of the whale's mouth at Storytown, now known as the Great Escape, in Lake George in high school. Best job, my current one that I've been at for 25 years. I manage water and wastewater treatment facilities in southern Vermont. Most might hear that and go, yuck, but it's fascinating, very fulfilling work. Every day is something different, and the work we do is important and necessary. Lisa in South Stratford says her worst job was cutting and pasting corrections into book pages before they went to press. Tedious. The best job, the one I have now, speech language pathologist. And Annie says the best job is right now. I love my job. I teach swimming and I own my own business. My worst job was working for a big insurance company in Manhattan back in 1989 and 90, calling people who had submitted insurance claims and trying to ensure they were being truthful. It was awful, and I finally walked out. Okay, so there are a few examples of the best and the worst. You can tell us what your job spectrum has been like. Call 1-800-639-2211. That number again, 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. And we're joined today by Renee Beaupré-White. She's Director of Career Services at Castleton University. Renee, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
It's going to take me a little while to get used to calling it Castleton University.
I know.
Excuse me in advance if I screwed that up. It's a pleasure to have you. And
thank
Peter
you.
Cole runs Cole Consulting. He's hired by companies to run leadership and job coaching sessions. And he can help us look at how companies avoid being the ones talked about in the worst job category and how employers and employees can work to better their relationship. Peter, welcome to you.
Thanks, Jane. So happy to be here.
Renee, what was your best or worst job?
Oh, well, I must say my best job is what I currently do as Director of Career Services. And I was thinking about my work. You know, I really don't have a job that I really haven't liked at all. I mean, I feel very fortunate in that way. So,
is that just luck or are you?
I believe that's very much luck.
Well, but surely you're also a good career coach for yourself then as well as for students.
Yeah.
Peter, what about for you?
Well, I'll go with Renee that my current job, 21 years doing what I do, I love being both a organizational development consultant working with companies and being a coach working with individuals. And for worst, I have to go all the way back to being a teenager, you know, the after school job, making money to be able to work my way through college. And it wasn't so much the job that I didn't like, it was the boss. I had a boss who was an extreme bully. And that was very difficult to take, especially being 16, 17 years old.
Yeah, and I am guessing you didn't feel like you had a lot of agency in that.
No, very, very little. And I needed the job, and there were not a lot of jobs to be had at that time. So, and my father had got me the job, so it was complicated in that way.
Do you feel now like you've learned anything from that job, despite it not being a very pleasant experience?
Absolutely. I think every job I've had, even from the jobs that only lasted one day, as a longshoreman for one day on the Portsmouth, New Hampshire docks.
Just one day?
Yeah, one day, because I realized I didn't want to go back and do that. But I learned how to not be afraid of heights, how to climb 100 feet down into a hole of a great big tanker ship. And it was fascinating, but I learned I didn't want to do that. I didn't want to be a longshoreman.
So that was probably good to learn.
Good to know. Yeah, exactly. I was 21 years old. Good to know that.
Renee, when you're working with students, how do you even help them figure out where to start? I mean, presumably, you're working with students who are going to graduate from college and trying to then find a career. So they may well have had jobs, maybe lots of jobs. But
right. How
do you sort of gear them towards where to even think? Because it's overwhelming when you're trying to figure out what kind of career do I want to have?
It is. And what I really focus on is working with students and matching their skills, their interests, and their values with careers. Because, you know, if what we do, you know, if what we have is not in sync with what we're seeking. So it's really important that our skills match and our interests and our values, careers to consider. So I really work closely with students in identifying those things, and then matching them with careers of interest.
But even that, I can take myself back to my 21, 22-year-old self and think, that sounds overwhelming. Somebody's mm-hmm. telling you to match your values right. and your passions to a career. I studied anthropology, and I can even remember my parents saying, what in the world are you going to do with a degree
right.
like that?
Right.
And me saying, I don't know. I just like what I'm studying.
Right. So, and I also really encourage students to be flexible and to try things. And, you know, because if you know, so many of my students and former students have shared stories with me of things that, you know, they've just, you know, explored things they never thought they would. And so, in other words, you know, let happenstance happen. Try, you know, if somebody mentions something to you or says, oh, you might be interested in this, to really try it. Because, you know, so many times things unfold that way. And so to be very flexible, I think, is really important and open-minded.
So do you coach them that this doesn't have to be your forever job
or
your forever career?
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. And, you know, and it's okay if it doesn't work. I think so often we're just so focused on, you know, it has to work and it's got to, but, you know, it's okay. You know, and again, the more we do, the more we know, and the more we know what we want or not want. So I think it's the more we put ourselves out there and learn about, you know, different careers, the better. And I'm constantly connecting our students, doing informational interviews, job shadows with professionals, just so they get a really good understanding before they launch and head out.
Peter Cole, when you're working with companies that you're coming in to try to change the culture or fix some things about a company that maybe just that doesn't feel right internally to the company, you must, though, experience coaching sessions, even with senior leadership, where they did that, what Renee is talking about, sort of fall into a path and then wound up staying in it when maybe it wasn't quite the right career path. I imagine you must sometimes say, why are you even in this job or
right.
field?
More often than I would like to do.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Well, I think in part because people have a desire to be connected to their values. And as Renee was saying, that's often where they start, what draws them to a particular job or particular company, I should say. And then they get, you know, things happen. Business happens. The day-to-day takes over, and all of a sudden you lose sight of what was really important, what was essential to you in wanting to pursue this career and join this company and join this team or start this company. I work with a lot of entrepreneurs who all of a sudden turn around and go, wait a minute, I'm 20 years in. I thought I was going to be doing this. Instead, I'm running around, you know, taking care of all these little details.
We got a note from Ken in Shelburne who has sort of the opposite experience, somebody who worked for many years and then started his own company and has found that to be a really valuable experience. He says, after 33 years at IBM, I retired, not, to fulfill my lifelong dream by starting a vineyard and a winery, Shelburne Vineyard. I find it exhilarating. I'm working harder than in my previous life, but loving it. Being my own boss, and yes, this comes with the challenge to make a profit, and being a pioneer and creating something in a new direction for Vermont agriculture. My earlier job was a very, very good one, but the passion you bring to a job is what separates a good job from a great one, and I feel lucky to have taken this plunge. Listeners, we are calling out for your memories of your best or worst job experiences. What job description have you held that was truly lousy? And what was the best job you've ever had? How do you work towards the good end rather than the bad as you move forward in your career? That's what our guests are helping us with, and you can call in with your stories, 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or send an email to vermontedition@vpr.net. Colin's on the line with us from Fairfax. Hi, Colin. Go right ahead.
Hi. So I heard your program, and this is really relevant to my life last 12 months, so I figured I'd call in. I was very involved in college. I was the student trustee, actually, for the Vermont State Colleges. Went to Johnson. I double majored in biology, political science. So after graduating, you know, I really thought I'd be able to just slide right into my career and start start life out here in Vermont, but it was not that simple. I went to about just under a dozen interviews over the course of 12 months before I settled into the career I have now, and I couldn't be happier with where I am. But when those 12 months were going through, it was a lot of just, you know, trying to stay optimistic. And a piece of advice that I got was, you know, don't think about what your dream job is. Think about the three things that make that your dream job. Mm-hmm. So I identified, you know, being able to talk to people in my community, being able to be in my community, and just, you know, I like the environment. So I always try to, you know, associate whatever I was doing with those three things, and just made it a little easier to get by those 12 months without, you know, finding, locking anything in.
Colin, that sounds like really good advice. What actually are you doing now?
I actually work for the town of Fairfax. I'm the director of the Recreation and Parks Department.
Ah, cool. Well, thank you for calling in. I appreciate it. And I'm glad that after those 12 months, you found something that you really enjoy. Renee, I'd love to hear your perspective as you listen to Colin, because, you know, it sounds like he's in the same vein as a lot of the people you're working with.
Right. So I'd like to start with just saying finding a job is a job. You know, it's effort. And it's, unless you're very, very lucky, a job will land on your lap. But most times it doesn't. So you really need to put a lot of, as much effort as you can. When I work with students, especially as freshmen, I tell them, start your career now. Your college career is, you know, your focus, put as much work into this as possible. And I tell them, I want you to treat your college years like your first professional job. In other words, you know, work hard, because whatever you're putting into it will be part of your resume by the time you're a senior and graduating. So it is, finding a job is a job. And I also just really want to highlight how networking and connections are so critical in finding a job. Over 80% of jobs today are found through a contact, through a connection. So it's really crucial for all of us to maintain and build our connections and contacts, especially in the fields that we're interested in.
I loved Colin's advice that he'd gotten, though, about finding, not thinking necessarily about can you get your exact dream job, but what are the elements that make it a dream job? Mm-hmm. Peter Cole, does that resonate with you, that if you can find the things that you love within a job, you're in good shape?
Absolutely. When I made my first transition from my first career as an educator to energy management, I picked up Richard Bowles' book, What Color Is Your Parachute? Yeah, great text. This is back in 1979. I think it's in its 20th edition now. But back then, it did exactly that. It had you sit down and do exercises to really take a look at yourself and see what are the elements, what are the things that you really enjoy, and not to go out and look for jobs necessarily. But his suggestion, which I now forward on to all my coaching clients, is to go out and interview other companies and within the industries that you think it might work, and see if there's a match to what you're passionate about, you know, and that also connects to your core values.
Well, it sounds like if you're interviewing other companies as well, you may be making some of those connections that Renee is talking about, even if you're just going in to say, could we talk about what you do here with no job on the line?
Absolutely. In fact, Richard Bowles says that you're not looking for a job. What you're really looking for is the right culture fit. And a lot of my work as an organizational development consultant is working with companies to pay attention to their culture. Because the fact is, people, the prime motivator, the research says, is not a paycheck. It's not the dollars and cents. It's what joy you get from the community that you work with. And the motivation is really more around your sense of purpose, what you're accomplishing during the day. And as we heard from Colin, you can do that by working for the town and the rec program. It doesn't have to be what you thought was going to be the package that was right for you.
I've always been able to get 2 out of 3 of the things that I most want in a job, which are to make enough money to survive, to be able to write, and to travel. And I've always figured 2 out of 3 isn't too bad, right? You know, at least I'm getting what I, you know, most of what I need in these jobs.
As with all of us, you don't have to get it all right now.
Right.
Mm-hmm. If it's travel that's you're not getting right now, which is, maybe that's my assumption, but you can travel later. Or, you know, in a couple of years from now, you could take a sabbatical. There's all kinds of opportunities. It's so great that we get to live such a longer life these days. And whereas in my parents' generation, it often, not for my father, but for so many of that generation, as we read about from IBM, you had to be with one company for your whole life, one career, one company the whole life. That's so not true anymore.
Well, speaking of that, let's go to Don, who's calling in from Mount Holly. Don, I understand you have no plans to retire yourself.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
Thank you for a great topic and a well-organized presentation. I think your guests are right on. I can honestly say at 76 next week, I am not working, and I have not been working for 41 years. I've been having a wonderful time in my own business after 13 years in corporate management. But the point of this is everything's a learning experience. One of the most rewarding things that I can do right now is work with people in recovery, and I did that Monday morning when a young man sent me a resume that I can forward to somebody, and if that makes a difference, that's what I want to do.
Don, thanks for your call. Appreciate that, and happy birthday next week. Harrison wrote to us to say, worst job was Barnes & Noble, but my best job, teaching geography in various international schools, and that happens to be right now. Christy posted on our Facebook page to say, I worked for a shipping company in Chittenden County as a data entry clerk, and we worked third shift and couldn't go home until the work was done, and we got no overtime pay. And Catherine's calling in from Castleton. Hi, Catherine.
Hi. Yes, I just wanted to comment quickly on the worst job I ever had, which was in 1970 in Salinas, California. I was a cajera in the lettuce field. I was a box girl. We took the flattened boxes for the lettuce and folded them up as fast as we could and tossed them as fast as we could to the workers who were cutting the lettuce. This was long before unionization. We worked on a piecework basis, and it was awful. I lasted 2 months. But on a larger sort of way of thinking, I want to say that everything you ever hear from any agricultural worker about abuse, whether it be physical or sexual or otherwise, is all true, okay? It's all true. And that's all I wanted to say.
Catherine, thanks for sharing your experience. Appreciate hearing it. We're talking about the best jobs and the worst jobs we've had and how to make sure you're getting into the former or making the best of the latter. And we're hearing a lot of your stories about your best and worst jobs. They're probably often more humorous in the telling than they were at the time, but please keep them coming. And let us know how you strategize to find a job that fits you better. You can tell us as well from the employer's perspective, how do you work with employees to make them happy or keep them happy, and how much do you see that as your role as an employer versus whether the employee should just, you know, take her lumps and work the job that she's been offered or that she's accepted. You can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Renee Beaupre-White is Director of Career Services at Castleton University. Peter Cole runs Cole Consulting. He's hired by companies to run leadership and job coaching sessions. They're helping guide us through a discussion that's peppered with your reflections on your best and worst jobs. And they're offering some good tips on how to make the most of a lousy job and how employers can make sure that they're not the ones being spoken of with such derision. You can share your reflections on what made your best or worst job so memorable. Call 1-800-639-2211, 1-800-639-2211, or post thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. John in Morrisville says, I'm one of the lucky success stories of working in Vermont, or anywhere, I suppose. This past July was my 35th year working at Concept 2, and it's been a great run. I'll offer up these observations as to what has made Concept 2 work for me. The people. Probably the most important bit is whether you get along with the people you're spending 40 hours a week with. The compensation package. It's always been appropriate, generous, and includes profit sharing, which gives one a sense of ownership. And I still feel like I'm learning and there are opportunities offered for further personal growth. Diane says, when I was about 15, I worked at Emerson's Wild Animal Farm in Newington, Connecticut. It also sold Western attire and footwear. My job was to walk around with the large boa constrictor draped around my shoulders for people to see and touch, and the very best was walking the female elephant and her baby by the trunk around outdoors in the country location that they owned. I've been in love with elephants and concerned about their welfare ever since. What a great experience for a 15-year-old girl. Nina Keck, VPR's own, you may recognize her name, says, my worst job was at my local fast food restaurant. I learned some valuable skills girls in my 2 years there while in high school. Always stay busy and look for things to clean and or to occupy your time. But my manager would chastise me in front of customers, which was so demoralizing. And Russ called in to say the best job was as a paralegal doing real estate work because he got to drive all over the state, which he loves to do. Let's go to Rachel calling in from Burlington. Hi, Rachel. Go right ahead.
Hi. Yeah, I think my question is more about the reality of choosing your job and, you know, maybe having to take a job that you don't like very much because of reality. So I developed a condition in college, and I needed to have health care in a significant way. And my worst job I had to have for 5 years in New York because I needed to have that health insurance. And it really felt like red tape around my life. So I just wonder if you have any suggestions for people who feel trapped in that situation. I think it's really a concern for a lot of people.
Yeah, Rachel, good point. I'm glad you brought that up. Renee, let's start with you. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think what's important is, you know, while you are in this position, that position is to just, you know, continually just seek other opportunities. Again, you know, make connections, talk to people, let people help you. That's one thing I really want to stress in this whole process. I think sometimes we go it alone. We go, you know, we do, and there are people that can help. There's counselors, there's state people, you know, there's so many career folks out there, and to really get assistance with it.
How do you advise doing that, though? I mean, depending on what kind of job you're in, it may cost money to hire a job coach or to do that kind of strategizing. And if you're in a job that you're in because you think, I need a job, I don't need to find a career that I'm passionate about, I need to make enough money to support myself or my family, I don't have time or money to hire a job coach, what do you do then?
Yeah, I know. It's that can be tricky. But I guess I would just, you know, encourage you to just, you know, let your close friends, associates know, and, you know, again, just let other people know what, you know, that you are seeking other opportunities and just to, you know, again, apply for positions, and try different things that might, you know, that might work.
What do you think, Peter? I mean, this is your field is doing that kind of career coaching, but what do you think for people who feel like their financial constraints or their life constraints make it difficult to feel like they have a lot of flexibility in choosing a career or moving jobs?
Well, I agree with Renee. It's keeping an eye towards what we can do outside of the 8 hours of the day or the 40 hours of the week, 50 hours of the week, where we need to get that paycheck, need to get the benefits. And really comes down to different ways to network, joining Chamber of Commerce, joining or a particular skill set that, that you really value, volunteering at the local shelter, animal shelter, or women's shelter, finding community outside of the workplace that's more aligned with your core values and who you are and what you aspire to. And that's
for finding a new job, not just for finding
absolutely
satisfaction in your own personal life.
Well, I think they go hand in hand because actually finding work is best done when we're in our positive selves, which is hard to do when we're in a job that is pulling us down. And so a lot of the work that we need to do when we're feeling defeated is to get ourselves back up again and all kinds of different ways. And you don't have to hire a job coach to do that. You can find community outside of the workforce or even within your work community, people who are positive. And now there's a whole field of positive psychology, people like Amy Cuddy who talk about actually using your body language to change your actual you know, energy.
Is she the one that talks about the superhero poses
exactly.
And do your power pose?
Yes. And it's in that vein of instead of fake it till you make it, still fake it till you are it. Mm-hmm. You actually, there's the neuroscience involved in actually changing your biochemistry. So it seems like another job on top of the job that you already have, but it's a job with tremendous benefits because it gets you in a place that actually will move you much faster to a different job with a different company and hopefully still with those important benefits.
We did get a note from Jay who says, look, I'm tired of people that say they're not satisfied working in a particular job. Here it is. The employer owes the employee a paycheck and a safe working environment. The employee owes the employer a good job. I assume he means by doing good work. That's it, Jay says. So, Renee, what about that? I mean, we're talking here about find your passion, find things that you enjoy. But what about just a job is a job, put your head down, do the work, and find fulfillment elsewhere?
Oh, no. I believe that we're our best when we are working, you know, in a culture where we're valued, where our employer values us, when we're able to contribute our skills, our gifts. So I see our works as, you know, really a place for us to really thrive and flourish. And again, it's only up to us to seek that. And it's really, and only we can do that. And, you know, with the help of coaches and counselors and friends and families, but really it's up to us to really, to make that happen. So I really believe that, you know, it really is our responsibility to seek out. And, you know, and today, there's so many great ways to find, you know, information about companies, organizations, and just to do our best and to be really persistent, you know, if you to identify companies, places, and to be persistent about it. If you're really interested I always say persistence pays off. I have that in my office, and I do believe that. I think we have to just keep our eye on the prize. And
listeners, we're talking about best and worst jobs and what makes the difference between the two. And we're hearing some of your anecdotes, some funny, some fairly serious. And we'd love for you to share yours, reflect on what you're hearing here. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. We got a note from Jill in Pomfret who says, I'm a 52-year-old woman and I've had over 25 different jobs. I changed tires. I moved baggage for People's Express. I worked for a trucking company. I was a bank teller, a waitress, and a teacher for 6 years. For the last 16 years, I've had a small house painting business. And for the last 4 years, I've been flipping houses in the Upper Valley. I really enjoy flipping houses, and I love the flexibility of my schedule. Justine says, I have the great good fortune to work for and with one of my very best friends who owns and operates a licensed family home childcare in Shelburne. We spend our days with young children who range in age from 3 months to 5 years. Our work is hard, full of fun and silliness, and never, ever dull. The best part of my job is the love that's exchanged between the children, the teachers, and the parents. It is a strong and palpable feeling. We're going to go back to the calls, but Peter, I know you wanted to jump in here before we move on.
Well, just to follow up on what Renee was saying, it's not just our work is to do our best work. More and more of the research shows that it's up to businesses to do what's right for the employees. All the data shows that the most successful businesses year after year are the ones that actually do care about their employees, who aren't just treating people like cattle, and actually are investing in their human capital. It's especially in this day and age, it's probably the most important capital that a company has. And so we're seeing more and more and more companies that are paying attention to their employees, offering them a sense of connection to their who they are, their values, and helping them do meaningful work, that they're actually performing much better on the bottom line.
Does that go for companies or for employees that are making minimum wage and that are the sort of the low end of the salary range in these companies? We've been hearing a lot recently about Netflix, which changed its family leave policies to allow parents to have a long time off from work after the birth of their child. But that only applies to the sort of white collar workers rather than the company staff that is the lower wage earner. So, Peter, are you finding that companies are feeling that way even about employees that they may see as more expendable?
Well, again, different companies see expendability in different ways. I think Jay's point was that he sees companies think everyone's expendable. And there are other companies that realize that even hiring janitors, you know, who could be considered expendable, the cost to recruit, to train, to bring a new person in, that's a cost. Whereas if you can take care of the person who is seemingly in an expendable position, and you can help them do work that they feel good about, so they're actually promoting. There is a really great article in the New York Times just this past weekend about jobs, and really looking all the way back to Adam Smith's position that, people are expendable and jobs are expendable. And the article, the journalist was really saying that, really flip that on its head and really take a look at when people really care about their work, even if they're being just doing janitorial work, it makes a huge difference to everybody. And so they actually spoke about someone who was a janitor at a hospital, and they saw their job, not just sweeping the floors, but actually helping the doctors, helping the nurses, helping patients feel better about themselves. They feel great about the work that they do, even though they're making probably minimum wage, pushing a broom, but they have a sense of purpose.
Mm-hmm. Let's hear from some more of our listeners who are weighing in here with their memories and their thoughts on this conversation. Marilyn is with in Lake Elmore. Hi, Marilyn. Go right ahead.
Hi, Jane. Thank you for taking my call. My husband and I have two pharmacies, and a number of years ago, we hired a young man in the summer. He was in high school. His mother was a friend of ours. He was a good worker. He worked all summer, and at the end of the summer, he said, I don't know how you do it, talking with all these people and helping them solve their problems. I could never work in retail. Well, he went on to become a surveyor. So he learned something very valuable that summer, was that he didn't want to work in retail.
Marilyn, good for you for giving him that opportunity and still following up to see what he wound up doing. Appreciate that call. Matt's in St. Albans. Hi, Matt. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing?
Great.
Hey, this is a great show, so thanks for taking my call. I just, the job I had, that I don't know if it was my the worst or best. I worked in high school one summer in an ice cream warehouse where they kept the temperature between 0 and 10 below Fahrenheit. And so I'd work in a big snowsuit, and then if I needed to warm up on a hot day like today, I would go outside, and the neighbors thought I was this crazy guy in a snowsuit in 90-degree heat. And then one day, I got a little bit of frostbite on my feet, and my boss sent me to the doctor to be out of an abundance of caution. And the doctor said it was the worst case of frostbite he'd seen all summer.
Oh, no.
All summer.
But, Matt, you said you're not sure if it was the best or the worst. That sounds pretty bad. Why the hesitation?
I'm sorry?
Well, so what would have made it the best job? You said you weren't sure if it was the best or the worst. What made it good?
Well, I think what made it good was it was a funny story, and plus, you know, I stayed cool, and I had a great bunch of people to work with, and it was just another life experience.
Yeah, and probably some free ice cream, Matt. Thank you for the call. I appreciate that. Martin's calling in from Plymouth. Hey, Martin, go right ahead.
Hey, Jane. Good afternoon, and thanks. Great show. So I think this was the worst job I ever had. When I was in college about 30 years ago, my uncle, who was a Teamster union guy, got me a job third shift, 12 to 8 in the morning, working at a chicken feed factory. And the way they particularly made chicken feed at this place was they purchased all the expired tins from civil defense air raid shelters, which I didn't even at the time knew existed. So we would cut open these beautiful brass tins on a factory fluorescent lit floor with a bandsaw, pile them up in, and there would be pallets of these things. And every one in a thousand tins, and they were indistinguishable from the other tins, would be filled with candy, little multicolored round gum balls, I guess, hard candies. And that was always amazing, because when it hit the bandsaw, it had a different sound than crackers. We were cutting open crackers, saltines, and it was just a very funny thing. They would spill out onto the floor, and it was the only bright moment in an otherwise completely drudge-filled evening or early morning.
Wow.
And I think about that job. So, and I thought it was very interesting that the government never never let anyone, well, there was no, they came right from the shelter, so there was no marking on the tins whatsoever. You would think you were, and I would always imagine people in a nuclear Holocaust situation opening up a tin of crackers, but would find gumballs. So that's my story.
Martin, at least it gave you something to think about while you're opening those tins. Wow, what a story. One more here. Jose is calling in from Barnett. Hi, Jose. Go ahead.
Hi, Jane. I wanted to introduce a topic that is near and dear. Over the years, I've been a person who's done a number of different jobs, most of them that go on for 4, 5, 6 years at a time. But anyway, to get to the point is that I noticed that the role of manager is given to people who are totally not able to discharge that responsibility, that they've had no training, they've had nothing, and often, you know, to allow them to be effective in that role, and leaving the worker totally subject to this person's whims, attitudes. I've had both. I've had great managers, but overall, it seems to be a common thread. It's something that's given to somebody who doesn't have the training to do it, and often doesn't have the disposition.
Jose, thanks for the call. I appreciate that. You know, that can certainly affect for the employees who are underneath that manager, how they feel like their experience is going. Renee, I want to bring you in here at the end, but Peter, your thoughts quickly on that.
Well, that's probably half of the work that I do in organizational development is actually helping leaders be both good managers and good leaders. And it's different skill sets for different people. Some people need to focus more on the interpersonal, their emotional intelligence. Some people just don't know, as Jose was saying, they just don't have the basic skills. They don't know, have the communication skills. They don't know how to organize. And so what I love about my work is that it's different each time. But helping managers be better managers has a great cascading effect.
You know, Renee, as we wrap up this conversation, we've heard a lot of people talking about jobs that they really didn't enjoy at the time, but as we discussed right at the beginning, have really been learning experiences for them. And I imagine that's something that you do try to tell 21, 22, 25-year-olds who are graduating from Castleton University and worried about, you know, this job is going to make or break the rest of my life.
Right, right. Yeah, right. Yeah.
So when you talk to them, you know, how, as we wrap this up, how do you think about talking to people about how to put their worst job into perspective as they search for their best?
Sure. Well, I treat it like an opportunity, you know. Again, I feel we learn sometimes from our failures and what hasn't worked, you know, and they're great for us to know, because that way it just, you know, it really puts things in perspective as what we, you know, what we do want and won't settle for and won't, you know. So I think you know, I always see it as an opportunity for students.
Renee Beaupre-White is Director of Career Services at Castleton University. Renee, thank you so much for talking with us.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
Peter Cole runs Cole Consulting. He's based out of Shelburne and New York City. Thank you for talking with us, Peter.
My pleasure, Jane.
Coming up, Vermont's Attorney General is investigating allegations of Medicaid fraud by the Brattleboro Retreat. We'll talk with reporter Dave Graham, who broke that story. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. State officials have launched a criminal investigation into the Brattleboro Retreat following a whistleblower's allegations of extensive Medicaid fraud. Dave Graham is a reporter for the Associated Press. He broke the story and joins us now. Hi, Dave. Nice to talk with you.
Hi, Jane.
So this investigation is looking specifically at whether or not the retreat defrauded the federal government and patients?
Well, it's the whistleblower alleges that there are several targets or victims of the fraud. Thomas Joseph, the whistleblower, former retreat employee, maintains that the state and federal sort of combined Medicaid program in Vermont was one of them. And he also says that some private insurance companies were subject to the same sort of treatment. The government investigations tend to focus on government money. So it would be perhaps down the road at some point if private insurers started to get interested in this stuff. I haven't really pursued that side of it yet. The allegations by Thomas Joseph are that for years the retreat would have situations in which patients essentially have been overbilled. In some cases, just billed for more days than they were actually staying there, according to him. Again, these are all allegations. They have not been proven, but they are under investigation by the Attorney General. The Attorney General's office has a Medicaid fraud unit, which specializes in going after cases of healthcare providers defrauding the program. And that's the that's where this is happening, this investigation.
Well, Thomas Joseph, he's a former retreat employee, and he's been raising these allegations about fraud at the retreat for years, seemingly without any success. So what changed that now has the Attorney General looking into these allegations?
Well, I think it's more a matter of the allegations don't seem to have changed much since. We should explain that in two instances at the federal level, Thomas Joseph was unsuccessful. First, in 2013, he went to the U.S. Attorney's Office in Burlington and asked them to sort of join him in a case. There's a piece of federal law which says that a citizen can actually bring a whistleblower complaint in conjunction with the government, and then if there's money recovered, the citizen can get some of that money. And that's what Thomas Joseph was initially trying to do. The U.S. Attorney's Office at the time said they looked at it for a little while and then said we're not going to pursue this. And then Thomas Joseph decided to go on his own to federal court. And last year, just about a year ago now, Judge Sessions in the U.S. District Court in Burlington essentially said that he had not sufficiently established the and proof of these allegations and dismissed the lawsuit. He had been approaching state officials too, including Doug Hoffer, the auditor of the counts. And Hoffer basically seems to have been a little more interested in what the allegations were that Thomas Joseph was raising. And he looked at it had a member of his staff look at it. They determined that a couple of other state agencies would be better equipped to actually investigate, one of them being the Program Integrity Unit at the Department of Health Access. That's the program in state government that actually handles Medicaid payments. And then there's the Medicaid Fraud Unit at the Attorney General's Office. So Hoffer referred the matter to those two programs. It's the Medicaid Fraud Unit that actually conducts a criminal investigation if they decide that's warranted. And I first got wind of the fact that there was a criminal investigation going on because I had made a couple of public records requests to the auditor for materials that Thomas Joseph was sharing with him, and also for communications between the auditor's office, the attorney general's office, and the Department of Vermont Health Access.
Did you just do that because you were interested, or did you have a sense that this was actually picking up some steam, whereas, you know, the reports, as you've mentioned, over the past couple of years have seemed like everybody who looked at this case was saying there's not enough merit there to investigate?
Well, I guess Thomas Joseph was pressing me and I think other reporters in the state to look into this matter and felt as though, you know, it was essentially an improper decision that he got from the federal court and the federal prosecutor's office. And so I sort of started just digging into it because legislative session's over. I had a little more time in the summer. So I made these public records requests just to see if there was anything there at the state level. And the first one, Doug Hoffer handed over 45 documents. The second one, I got a letter from him, which he said was drafted by the Attorney General's office, saying these records are exempt now because they are subject to a criminal investigation. There is an exemption under the public records law where an agency can say that. So I rather easily concluded, wow, there's a criminal investigation going on. That's something that's interesting and potentially newsworthy. And it took a little work to get the Attorney General on the record to acknowledge that was happening. But eventually happened, and the story resulted from that.
Well, and it sounds like you're still not getting a lot of details from the Attorney General into exactly what that criminal investigation entails.
Right. He says that it's broader than the Thomas Joseph allegations. So, and there was one instance of a public record I saw indicating that, or a couple actually, that they were looking at stuff beyond what Thomas Joseph initially raised. And he certainly, the Attorney General certainly indicated that in our interview. So it's really hard to know exactly, you know, where this leads and how it's all going to sugar off. But it's definitely an ongoing investigation, and the retreat has acknowledged that, and that's pretty much where it stands.
Do you have a sense, Dave, of what the outcome could be, what could happen to the Brattleboro retreat if these allegations are proven true, even if they're just the allegations that Thomas Joseph was raising?
Well, it could be, Thomas Joseph maintains that they have defrauded, committed fraud worth $11 million. That was in his federal lawsuit. And if it turns out that it's anything like that, that obviously is a big chunk of money. The retreat, I the state officials were looking at their financial statements and saying that they're not real flush. They're running a big and complex operation, but it's a pretty tight budget situation for them. And so if all of a sudden they were told they needed to pay back millions of dollars, that would obviously be, I would think, rather detrimental to the organization.
Dave Graham is a reporter for the Associated Press. He's been telling us about his reporting on why state officials have launched a criminal investigation into Medicaid fraud at the Brattleboro Retreat. Thanks for talking with us, Dave.
Thanks for having me.
The Brattleboro Retreat is an underwriter for Vermont Public Radio. And that's it for today. Vermont was recognized this week for state programs to promote breastfeeding. But some moms say there's still a very fraught conversation going on, even among moms, about formula versus breastfeeding and a lot of guilt and perceived judgment no matter what you do. Tomorrow, we'll dive into the discussion and talk about supporting mothers and babies. You can send your questions or your experiences with breastfeeding to VermontEdition@vpr.net and listen to the show tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sam Gail Rosen, with production assistance from Aaron Lucy. Mary Williams directed the show, and our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.